Most High, I come to you giving you thanks and praise for keeping me in sound body and mind. I ask you to forgive me for all my indiscretions, all that I have done and all that I will do. I ask you to open me up, use me as your vessel, let my voice be yours. Speak your mission through me, allow the listeners to open up and receive it the way you intended. No holds barred, use me. I look at the news and I watch other people's nations formed over.
I'm a treasure hunter. And I'm just, you know, I know what I'm looking for. And I'm just happy to be good at it. Christopher says I'm just lucky.
luck repeated over and over again has to be some sort of forethought, has to be some sort of, at this point, intuition, where, like you said, you just, it's a gift. You have it. You've nurtured it longer than anybody has. And you know almost beyond the five senses, maybe. I'd be drawn to these things almost.
Well, I mean, you notice I'm not going by notes or referring to anything.
And that's one of the things that impresses me about
it. You know, I know this stuff right off the top of my head.
That's one of the things that's impressed me. Because, again, there are no notes here. We're sitting down on Mr. Kim's kitchen table, and all this stuff comes out as if I'm in a lecture hall at, I'm going to say North Carolina State University because that's where it went. I'm in a history lecture hall. And have you been invited to universities? Or I know you and Chris show the film to students, and I saw the film at an event at St. Augustine.
Yeah.
That was about a year ago. February of 2016. That's when I first saw the film.
Yeah.
But have you been invited to universities or things like that to speak? Because, I mean, you could better than they could.
Yeah. I haven't really been invited by universities. I know they're interested. I know they want me to. Mm-hmm. But I think they're afraid I'm going to charge them, you know. And, but I mean, I do middle school screenings all the time, and I do them for free. Mm-hmm. Usually, I bring in my own equipment and show the film, and I do a question and answer with the kids, and I always do those for free. And I'll keep right on, but I mean, if the universities, you know, if they want to hit me up, you know, I'm available.
What's the response been like for most middle school students? Because the truth is, nobody in North Carolina knows about this. It's not in the history books.
No.
It's not being told. So what is, and I mean, as an adult, DJ saw it, and she's like, oh, my God. I just kept hearing, oh, my God.
Well, right now, we've got universities in North Carolina that are actually buying the DVD and buying the license from Speller Street Films. We have a package deal that's a discount that we give to schools, where they can buy the DVD and they can buy the license and they can use the DVD to teach the children and teach their students. And this has been mainly universities, the proper history of 1898. And that's starting to happen now in North Carolina. And I think we've had, I think, five or six universities in North Carolina have already done that.
Are you at liberty to say which ones? Are they state universities?
Well, I do know University of North Carolina at Wilmington has. Okay. I do know they have.
Okay.
I'm not sure about the rest of them. Christopher said there's been five or six, I think, in North Carolina.
And what about middle school? What's the reaction like for middle school students?
Well,
who probably don't even really learn slave history or Civil War anyway.
Well, they're actually, the middle schools are using the book Crow to try to teach some about 1898, because the author of Crow actually touches on 1898 in Wilmington a little bit in her book, okay? So what they're doing is they're using our film to augment that part of her book to kind of expand on what she said.
Okay.
And it's very well received. We watch the kids very closely, and we've noticed they never go to sleep.
It's a big deal.
You know, and the teachers always comment about, you know, look, we show these guys, you know, a 20-minute film, and by the time 20 minutes up, three-quarters of them are asleep. You know, they haven't even watched a film. Your film's an hour and a half long, and we can't get them to go to sleep.
So they do this in one setting.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And nobody...
Nobody goes to sleep.
I thought it would be like... Like you said, you break it up in 30 minutes.
They're riveted.
What is the part that consistently gets the most reaction from 12 to 14-year-olds or whatever the case
may
be? Besides everything that you say every time you show up.
I don't know, man. I've had them ask me to autograph their foreheads with magic markers and stuff. It's kind of crazy. Because usually when we're showing it, We're showing it to 150 to 200 students, 250 sometimes. They, you know, sometimes they laugh. I've seen them cry. I've never seen them sleep. I mean, they're riveted. And then usually they ask really good questions at the end. And they always want to see it again. You know, when can we see it again? Yeah, I feel good about it, and I feel optimistic about our kids. Hopefully, we'll cure this problem we have in the United States known as racism, which, by the way, is a taught affliction. I've never met a racist that was born one.
Part of your interest in, I think, telling the truth of this story, not just about Wilmington 1898, but about what happens after and all the other unknown despicable acts that have been done, particularly in North Carolina, but anywhere in this country, concerning this affliction of race and racism. And in speaking to you before we started recording, you mentioned your father, that you grew up in the North. Not that the North is, you know, like racist free or anything like that. No. But obviously somebody had to cure in you or teach you there is a better way. Was it based on a religious sort of upbringing, or what was it from your history, your family's history, where, I mean, you almost to this point, it's ingrained that this is bullshit. This racism stuff is bullshit.
Yeah.
And we don't as a cancer, we don't do this shit.
Well, it's, you know, my family was all raised in the North, but I was actually raised in the South. I've never lived in the North. I've lived in Wilmington, I've lived in Brunswick County, and I've lived in South Carolina. I've lived in Charleston and Somerville. And, you know, I grew up around black people all the time, my whole life, you know, and I never really saw black and white. You know, I mean, I saw friends and neighbors and everything. I mean, look at the neighborhood I live in. You know, my neighbors, you know, my next door neighbor's an Iraqi war vet. Guy next door is retired. They're both white. The guy on the other side of that, he's a black guy. His wife's black. Their children are black. They're best friends with my kids. You know, they go to school together. They hang out. I got their phone number. You know, I've got their phone numbers. We're friends. The next people, they're black. People across the street, the lady next door, she's a black lady. You know, I live in a mixed neighborhood, all right? And I don't even see color with my friends and my neighbors. I think that's what makes me different, you know, and that's what I'm teaching my children. I've given up on the generation above mine. I'm 54. People above about 65, they grew up under Jim Crow. They were taught to think that way. You know, I wasn't raised under Jim Crow. I'm probably the first generation that wasn't raised under Jim Crow. Now, it did exist when I was a kid, but my family didn't practice it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm hoping that slowly we've gotten out of a lot of our governmental institutions, but it's not devoid from our society,
right. Okay?
It's still here. We know it. I had a relative call me last night. I haven't spoken to them in several years, and they're a racist. They've heard about my involvement with this film, and, you know, they call me the M-word lover. Oh, so I heard you're being an M-word lover again, you know? It's like, bye, click.
Mm.
You know, I mean, I ain't even got time.
How many of those have you had to cut off? How many family members?
Well, I've got 5 older brothers and sisters, and I've had to cut off all 5 of them.
One child grows up to be somebody that just loves to learn and love.
child grows up to be somebody you just love to burn. Mom loves the both of them. You see, it's in the blood.
Was it spurred on by the film or just...
No. Just from they've been racist their whole lives. And I pushed them away a long time. Because, number one, I don't want to hear it. Number two, I don't want them doing that to my kids. And number three, I've got a daughter. She just happens to be married to a man who just happens to be black. And my grandchildren are from him. Mm-hmm. And when I hear them use the N-word, I feel like slapping the taste out of their mouth because they're talking about my grandkids.
Right.
Okay? And I don't want to hear it. I don't want to hear it. Period.
But you're still checking each other out. Hey. Nobody wants to blow. Nobody wants to be left out.
If I go somewhere and I hear somebody using that word, I'll walk up to him and ask him real nice, you know, hey, man, would you do me a favor and, you know, just chill with that, you know, and if they don't like it, well, you know, we can go from there, you know. I asked.
But you're crying anyway, because you're all broke down. It's a family affair.
It's a family affair.
It's a family affair. Oh, yeah, family.
The film is getting some buzz and getting some pub. That's also putting you in the spotlight around here. So what's the reaction been? Because, again, we're still in North Carolina. We're still in rural, more or less, North Carolina. What's the reaction been personally for you and your family?
From the white people.
More or less.
Well, I've gotten reactions from both white and black people. From white people, I've had absolutely no backlash virtually at all. I mean, I did run into some racist up in Goldsboro, and when I called them outside and they came outside, they decided they didn't want to hang around, and they all ran. That was 5-on-1 that time. As far as black people goes, that's where I've kind of got some backlash from. I've had some black people accuse me of stealing their history and getting rich off of it. And that they want some of the money. And I'm just like amazed that they would actually come at me like that because, number one, I haven't made a dime off of this. Nothing. I mean, not zero.
And the director, Christopher Everett, producer, is black.
Yeah. And, you know, and not only that, but Christopher and I, we worked together in promoting the film and going out meeting, greeting people and stuff like that, you know, and we don't do it for the money. I've been branded Klan sympathizer, child molester, a coke smoker, you know, all because I won't give them money because I supposedly stole their history and got rich off of it. I had my money before I ever even met Christopher Everett, so I don't know what they're talking about. And I didn't make it off of black people, I can tell you that right now. I was a roofer for 29 years. Here's the back I made my money off of right here. I'm telling you, it's hard work.
I gotta testify. Come up in the spot looking extra fly. For the day I die, I'ma touch the sky. Gotta testify. Come up in the spot looking extra fly. For the day I die, I'ma touch the sky.
There's no solution, no answer to racism. It's going to be individuals who need to be taught. But do you think that's going to be a major point? Because it will happen where there's a segment of the American population who grew up practicing under Jim Crow. They're going to be gone in the next 10, 15
years. Yeah, the next 10, 15 years they're going to be gone. All we can do is hope that they don't teach their children to carry on that legacy. See, you know, like I said, racism was a taught affliction. I know I'm breaking that cycle with my kids. You know, it's going to take an individual effort by every single solitary one of us, black and white, to teach our children not to be racist. Okay? And it's going to take all of us together and working together. Just us sitting together to hear this table, we've done it. We've done it. I got black people in a white man's house. You know, I mean, unheard of 30, 40 years ago. You know, would have been illegal in North Carolina, in fact. This meeting would have been a crime. So we're already doing it. And it's naturally, I think, especially with people like us pushing the issue, I think within 10 or 15 years, I think you're going to really start seeing a beginning of the end of racism in the United States. I think you're going to start to see it. I thought we saw the beginning of it when we elected Obama. I was wrong. That just brought it full head. And I'm glad now we know who they are and what it is, and we can confront it. You know, when you have a hidden society, hard to fight that. But when they come right on out, man, it's easy to beat them. You gon' touch the sky, you gon' touch the sky, baby girl, testify. Come up in the spot looking extra fly. For the day you die, you gon' touch the sky. Yes, 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 guess who's on third? Lupe still like looping the third. Here like here till I'm bitter on the curb. Peach fuzz buzz, but bitter on the verge. Let's slow it down like river on the serve. Bottle shaped body like Mrs. Butterworth. But before you say another word.
I wanted to come here to talk about Wilmington on Fire, ask a couple questions to get you to expand on a little bit more. I mean, you're one of the stars of the movie, the people that stand out in the movie. And again, getting to know you on Facebook, some of the things you post, you're very unapologetically real about the state of America. And we can go into that. But I did want to cover Wilmington on Fire. We've done that. And I wanted to get just a little bit about you. And I get that sense that obviously this racism was – or the anti-racist philosophy was taught to you by a very strong father and obviously
and
mother.
My mom was real anti-racist. There was no room in her day for even one iota of a second of it. She didn't want to hear it.
Looking back now, do you remember if they got backlash for that?
Oh, yeah. Oh, the Klan used to call my house and threaten my dad. He told him, come on with it. He didn't care. You know? My dad fought in World War II, the whole war. He joined when he was 24, December 8, 1941. He was 24 years old, and he was a diesel mechanic, a welder, pipe fitter. I mean, he had a lot of trades, okay? And when he joined the Navy, man, he moved right on up in rank real quick because he had all these trades. He was on a destroyer. And they used to repair landing craft. And about 6 months into the war, they took his entire white crew away from him and gave him an entire African-American crew. My dad had grown up in Waterbury, Connecticut, and there was one black family in his town that had a kid in school that went to school with him, right? It was the only time he'd really ever had any contact with black people. So they gave him all these black guys, it was like 40 of them, okay? And half of them were from the South and half of them were from the North. And that's when my dad first started finding out about racism and segregation and stuff, you know? And his ship got attacked numerous times during the war. He lost many of his crew members. He got wounded twice, you know? When he came out of the war, man, he had a whole different attitude about racism. You know, and about how white people treated black people. He didn't like it. The white veterans of the United States that came out of World War II are really the ones that integrated America. And a lot of people don't realize that. They came in from the war and they went to President Truman and said, look, man, you know, we don't like the fact that our armed forces are segregated. These guys are just as much Americans as we are. They bleed red. They fight. They're brave. Why in the hell are they segregated? Why do we treat them like second-class citizens? And Truman signed an order, an executive order in 1948, integrating the armed forces. And my dad was one of the people involved.
I think after every war, obviously at the Civil War, there's change in terms of the status of African Americans because the soldiers are going, look, We're dying for this right. World War I, the same thing. Black soldiers come back, and major race riots post-Civil War were after World War I, a huge swath of them in this country because so-called uppity niggers came back, thinking who the hell they were, because they actually said, we are Americans, we're fighting for this country. And they come
exactly.
back to
saying the same thing happened in the war with Spain. Okay, there was a big discussion within the African American community in the United States in 1898 as to where African Americans were even going to support the war with Spain. Because the fact they were saying America wants to go fight the Spanish for doing the same thing to black people right. that the Americans do to black people every
war.
Day.
World War One, you know, World War Two,
the same thing. World War One and then World War Two. But after World War Two, that's when you really had the white guys come back and go, wait a minute, No, man, we fought right next to these guys with them. They're brave. They're Americans. You need to treat them with fair justice. The Germans didn't care what color you were. You see what I'm saying? I mean, they'd kill you. You were an American.
Right, and that's okay. when the black soldiers are coming back.
And black soldiers would go over to France, and they weren't subjected to coloreds only, whites only. They were treated as Americans. They were treated as human beings. Right. And then the black soldiers would come back to America, and they were treated as third class, not even citizens. Right. You know, you're not even a citizen if you can't vote. Not even second class. You're property.
You don't own me. I'm not just one of your many toys. You don't own me. I don't say I can't go with other boys. Don't tell me what to say, and don't tell me what to do. Please, when I go out with you, don't put me on display. No,
we're in an evolutionary state with racism in the United States. We really are. And all I can do is my part, you know. I mean, I'm not a leader or anything like that.
Well, you are in your own way, and I think that's the point of why I wanted to have this conversation. My thing is more or less people power, and stop putting our hopes and wishes on the backs of politicians who are lifetime politicians, like your mayor friend that you presented all the information to. The fact is, the information is there for the people to discover, and the people really take it upon themselves to become full citizens of this country and do what they are prescribed to do by the laws of this country, and they have
as
the right to
duty as a
correct.
Citizen.
Be citizens. Be
That's right.
citizens. You, sir, are a woke citizen of this country, and this is one of the reasons I want to talk to you and let folks know a little bit more who may or may not have seen Wilmington on Fire. And it takes more folks woke like yourself to really be able to spread the gospel, not just of anti-racism, but literally the gospel of Americanism, what this country is supposed to be. And it is only now that we're kind of living the creeds of our forefathers, where this sort of liberalism that was written in the Constitution, that was written in the Declaration of Independence, but has never existed anywhere nope. in this country. It's only now, unfortunately, with the dying of these generations and with the truth finally being able to be preached out through movies like Wilmington on Fire or through the idiot rhetoric of our current president, where we understand this is not a lie, this is not a falsehood, this still exists, this is something
right.
we have to tackle. So it's only now in my mind that America is existing, and America is going to exist because there's a dying age of ignorance that has no purpose here. It serves absolutely nothing for us domestically and internationally.
Nothing.
And it's high time that people really, really start having. I mean, there were conversations before, but there were conversations where we were still so-called second and third class citizens. I'm not saying we're not still, as an African-American man, treated as such, because again, one of the ideas that we have to accept, we talked about it earlier. I mean, there's laws that say one thing, and then there's de facto reality. Confederate uniforms are still being made 5 or 6 years after the war ended, and they were still being worn 30 years after the war ended. So this idea that the war ended is a farce. It's a lie.
Yes, right.
I'm sorry. It's an alternative fact.
Yeah, there you go. You've hit the nail on the head.
It's an alternative fact. I'm not saying that to
and see, here's the thing. You know, it's like I was saying earlier. You know, the Confederacy never surrendered. They were crushed. There really is a big difference between surrendering and just being, just crushed. The Confederacy was crushed. All right? They never gave up. The only reason that their armies gave up is because they were surrounded about to be executed. I mean, it was, you know, that point is die or give up, okay? But the population was never put into that situation, right. All right? The population never gave up. And you can go through the history of the South after the Civil War, and you'll notice that they never gave up. They never did. And they still haven't. There's still segments of white Southern society who still think that way. Okay? And I can take you down in Southern Brunswick County right now. I can take you to a housing development. It's an actual city. It's a gated community. And it's absolutely pure white. Okay?
So what is... We passed through Whiteville, and I never thought about that.
Why?
Until learning more about
that. You call it Whiteville. It is called Whiteville.
Whiteville. So how did Whiteville come into existence just outside of Wilmington, which was a little bit of Blackville?
Well, when I was a kid, man, Whiteville had a sign outside of it that said, if you're black, don't let the sun go down on your ass. In Whiteville. And that sign was up there until I was probably 20, 21 years old, and somebody set it on fire.
So this is what years?
That would have been 84, 85 is when they burned that sign.
I remember they wrote an article in the paper about it because they were going to rebuild the sign and the city wouldn't let them do it. They passed a sign ordinance to keep it was a billboard. And so they set it on fire.
Don't let your back, the sun go down on your back.
On your black ass in Whiteville.
Wow.
Your eastern counties of North Carolina are predominantly your most racist. And the reason being is because this is where the plantations were. You couldn't grow cotton in the mountains. It wouldn't grow up there. So the people in the mountains, they didn't have slaves. So they didn't have that subjugation, that education to think like that, you know, that upbringing where, you know, well, I work on the plantation down the road, you know, and I oversee all their slaves, you know. They didn't have that. That wasn't part of their society. So when you really look at North Carolina, for your racism and your segregation, which still exists, you're going to find it predominantly in the eastern part of the section of the state, very heavily, to a lesser extent in the Piedmont, and to an even lesser extent
in the mountains.
When you get to the mountain areas of North Carolina. And just look at it. You'll see. Asheville, one of the most liberal cities in North Carolina, is it not?
Correct.
Where is it at?
Mountains.
And so when you look at where your plantations were, where your slaves were, this is it. I mean, it's right here. This was where it was at. When you came down here, you came down a road called Mount Misery Road, didn't you?
Mm-hmm.
Didn't you? Remember that? When y'all GPSed it and you drove over here, you had to come down Mount Misery Road to come to my house. Do you know why they call it Mount Misery Road?
I don't know if I want to know, but let's see.
I'm getting ready to tell you why. That was old Highway 87 that went from Wilmington to Fayetteville. That's how they used to march the slaves from Wilmington up to Fayetteville. And the slaves named it Mount the Road of Misery. Mount Misery. There's no telling how many African unmarked right. slave graves there are all along that road from where they took them off the ships in Wilmington and brought them across the Cape Fear River and marched them up Mount Misery Road to Fayetteville. And all along the way, all of this was plantations. And they would sell the slaves to the plantations on the way to Fayetteville. And then whatever was left when they got to Fayetteville, they would auction them off at the slave market in Fayetteville. And that's why that road is called Mount Misery Road. See, there's remnants of this history of our past right before your very eyes that you don't even know about. And it's right there. That's why you came to see me.
That's why I came to see you. I know you know this, and I think it's incumbent upon people, again, to exercise their rights as this smart human beings. We all have a brain to use, and we all have the capacity to use it well. You've certainly done that. And I think a lot of people think you have to have some sort of history degree. No, you have to have a curiosity and interest and the willingness, unlike the 1898 commission, to actually do the damn work.
Do you know the extension of my education?
No, sir.
I was at a screening the other night, man, and the moderator was calling me a history professor and doctor. And I had to, you know, I didn't interrupt him or anything. You know, I let him say what he was saying, but... Then afterwards, I went up to him and I said, Abdullah, I said, you know I'm not a doctor. No, actually, I quit 10th grade when I was 15 years old, and 3 days after I turned 16, I hitchhiked to Carthage, North Carolina, and took the GED at San Diego Community College and passed it. And I ain't been back to school since. And what I know, I taught myself. You notice there's a stack of books over there against that wall? Those are law books. I have a whole bunch of them, and I've read every one of them.
How important is it for everybody to understand at least a little facet of the law?
I would strongly recommend that everybody read not only the United States Constitution, but your state constitution. The reason why I say the state constitution, because that's where your local officials derive their powers. They don't get it from the federal constitution. They get it from your state constitution. Have you ever read the constitution for a state of North Carolina?
No, sir.
Have you ever read the constitution for a state of North Carolina?
I haven't.
Okay. Here's two citizens of the state of North Carolina, and you haven't even read your own state constitution. And that is the basis of all laws in North Carolina. And you haven't read it. If you're going to fight it, if you're going to reform it, if you're going to make it better, you have to know it first. Read that state constitution. Now, in the process of reading it, research it. Find out when they wrote it. Find out when they amended it. You will find that the constitution for the state of North Carolina is one of the most amended state constitution within the Union of the United States. And most of the amendments occurred during the 1920s when the white supremacists were in absolute control and they were cementing their authority over the state government. And they were doing it through this ultimate body of law, the state constitution.
So you're saying we should be wary of the Republicans in D.C. having control of both houses and then setting a precedent for the next 40 years of governance.
Yeah.
That's something we should kind of pay attention to.
Mr. President, distinguished delegates. Mr. President, distinguished delegates.
Since the beginning of modern civilization, generations of weakness and inherited only conflicts of world wars. But behold the marriage supper of the lamb and bridegroom unto his bride. Then shall the earth's children know the true expression of one love. Then Mother Earth shall honeymoon in peace, forever eliminating aspirations, lust, and anguish of wars and rumors of wars. See now.
Now the innocent growing up in papers and propaganda spreading in the Sunday papers.
now the clock has strike one on the amazed house. The men of them churches trying to save.
We as a society, until we teach our children, we're not going to change anything in this country. And that's what I work on. I work on our kids. And, you know, change their thinking or get them thinking right to begin with. Really don't even have to change their thinking. Just get them right, to begin with. Teach them the law. Don't throw your kids a set of car keys when they're 18 years old and tell them to go out there and figure it out for themselves. Because the way they're going to figure it out for themselves is behind bars. You as a parent have an obligation to teach your children. Not just right from wrong, but what society says is right and wrong. You have your own beliefs about right and wrong. Society has laws. And infractions of those come with penalties. And it's not a spanking. Don't turn your kids loose on society without at least teaching them the law. And your state constitution is the very beginning of it. Read that first. Now you know where they get their power from. If you want to strip them of their power, start stripping right there.
No disease and the germs in war. Can't go release your sperms in war. Stamina most preserving war. Fire constantly burning war.
We've been speaking to Mr. Chatfield Kent. It's been about 90 minutes, and we could go on all day because I have tons of other questions that I want to ask. And actually, we're getting into an area about citizenship that is incredibly important. I think this is the definition of a woke citizen in this country. And I mean, I see what he writes about our president, about what's going on in Washington. So we can talk about a lot of different things, and maybe that's issues for another episode, because I didn't even get into the two most interesting things that I heard this week, and it's only been this week about him having to put a gun to somebody's head because they wanted to kill him. So maybe I'm gonna tease that maybe for another conversation on another day, but I want to wrap up today again with Mr. Kent to thank him very much for giving us a couple minutes of his time to really find out a little bit more about him, and I hopefully. The people who are listening to this episode of the podcast and have not watched or screened Wilmington on Fire, you go out and you get that done. Go online. I think it's on Vimeo or go to
Vimeo on demand
or WilmingtonOnFire.com and purchase a copy of it because it's definitely worth it in terms of upping your understanding of a part of American history, a part of North Carolina history that has gone forgotten. But thanks to Mr. Kent, thanks to Christopher Everett, and those all involved in the film, kids are now being educated so that they can understand that the truth, first of all, and that they have the capacity to also bring light to other things that maybe, not maybe, but are going on now that we have no idea about, and sometimes we find out when it's way too late. So in terms of like citizenship, Mr. Kent, and I want you to address young folks because you say you spend a lot of time going to middle schools. I mean, what do you want them to get? Not just from the film, but to understand about their role as citizens in this country.
There's a strange news around things I've never known.
I say this to kids all the time when I go out. Man, stay in school. Do the best you can. You're getting it for free. Once you get out of this phase of school, you're going to have to pay for it, all right? The teachers who are teaching you, they're paying for that license to teach you. You need to take advantage of the money they're spending to teach you by listening to them. Learn everything you can. Learn the law. Pay attention to everything around you. Just do the best you can. Stay in school. Learn everything you can. Become as smart as you can. I wished I had took my own advice when I was a kid. I've learned from over life, my mistake. knowledge is the real power in America. What you know will get you through life. It's worked for me. I'm 54 years old and I'm retired. You know, I retired 6 years ago. You can do it. You don't have to work till you're 75 years old. Use your mind.
For the past 20 years, I've always wondered about those people who do get to go to college, because I know a lot of them, and a lot of them listen to this podcast, they're friends of mine. They heeded your advice, they went to school, they got a degree, but in terms of the activism and their willingness to kind of use that knowledge to foster change, what do you say to those people who kind of, they went about it, they did the right things, they did it, they stayed with it, but then they just get a job and just, you know what I'm saying? So my concern is those people.
They're wrapped up in the life of America that has been prescripted for them.
Right.
Buy mortgage, buy car on payments, you know, do this, do this is the way you're supposed to live. You know, try something different. You know, don't live by the cast of life that somebody else wrote for you, the screenplay.
Right.
That has been written for you. Write your own screenplay. Live your own life. Believe in what you want to believe in. Do what you want to do. And strive for that. You'll be much happier and much more successful. I hate it for people to pay for them degrees, man. Them student loans. I'm glad I ain't got them.
Knowledge is free and out there. You just got to be willing to put in the work to get it and then use it. The only way it's going to get in your bones and be part of you is you got to use it as much as humanly possible.
It's much wiser to hang out in the library and read a book than to hang out down at the gang clubhouse and, you know, do that thing.
Or be at home, educated, and sit down and do nothing.
Yep. Sometimes you got to get out there and do what you believe in. That's why I got thrown out of the Trump rally last year.
See, we could go down another path. That's another. there's a Trump rally that happened in Fayetteville, and
it's Hickory, North Carolina.
That's gonna be for another day. We're gonna have to cut this interview off at some time. So we're gonna end there. But I mean, more to come with Mr. Ken. Trump rally. We didn't even get into the Cheeto Satan that is in Washington D.C. right now. Impeach 45, by the way. We could get into that.
Or the dude that wanted to kill me for his job.
Or the dude that wanted... You see what I'm saying? Or when you saw the preacher having relations with somebody who was not his wife, and then you were sent to basically juvenile detention for years and had to escape. Again, there's so much more.
Yep.
Ubuntu Raid is going to come back with Mr. Chatfield Kent later on. In the meantime, catch him on Wilmington on Fire. Know that Christopher Everett and Mr. Kent are working on Wilmington on Fire 2. When should that be out?
We're hoping 2018? By the end of the year.
So 2017, 2018. Look for Wilmington
somewhere
on Fire.
Right in there.
In the meantime, go to Vimeo on demand. Get Wilmington on Fire. Learn about the history of North Carolina. And is there any way they can reach out to you? Reach out to Mr. Kent on Facebook. Just let him know.
Chatfield Kent, hit me up.
All right.
My profile's public.
You don't hide from nobody. All right. So speak some truth, and we'll continue speaking some truth. Chatfield Kent, my new hidden treasure. My new hidden treasure of knowledge and history about North Carolina. Ubuntu Radio is out, and we'll be back again some other time.
Yeah, it's for the people. This is street radio for unsung hero. Riding in the Rego, trying to stay legal. My daughter found Nemo, I found a new primo. Yeah, you know how we do it for the people. And the struggle of the brothers and the folks. The lovers of the dope. Experiment to discover hope, scuffle for notes. The rougher I wrote, times was harder. Went from rock starter to the voice of a martyr. Why white folk focus on dogs and yoga? My people on the low end trying to ball and get over. Lyrics are like liquor for the fallen soldier. From the bounce to the house. It's all our culture.